Hello, everybody. Quick announcement before the podcast today. Starting February 1st, I'm going to go travel the world for about a year, and I'm going to be releasing podcasts, blog posts, and YouTube videos along the way. So please go to dunktank.com, and you'll see a button on the right where you can enter your email and subscribe to get regular updates on all those fun things. That's it. Enjoy the show. Noam Chomsky is one of the top 10 most cited intellectuals of all time, alongside Freud, Shakespeare, and Karl Marx, and is considered the founder of the field of cognitive science. He is also a lifelong U.S. political activist and dissident. This is Noam Chomsky. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. Great. So I'm here with Noam Chomsky. Noam, thanks very much for joining me today.
Glad to be with you.
So I wanted to talk to you especially about climate change. But before we go into that, I kind of wanted to address some recent events. This is going to air, this podcast can air in a couple weeks, but today is January 13th, and it was only about 10 days ago that the U.S. assassinated the top Iranian general, Soleimani. There was a lot of debate on cable news over whether we should call this guy a terrorist or not, or what happened, an assassination. What kinds of questions do you think a free press should be asking about these events?
Well, the first question they should be asking is how they would react if Iran were to assassinate the top U.S. general, second highest figure in the U.S. government, in a Mexico City airport, also killing the commander of a large part of the army that the U.S. supports in an allied state. How would they react? Well, we know how they'd react. They'd be calling for a major attack against Iran, a devastating retaliation for this act of international terrorism. So then the next question they should ask is, why aren't they saying that? Is there such a thing as a free press? Or is the press just an agent of the government? That's what they should be asking themselves.
It's been a particularly eerie beginning to the new decade, not just this business with Iran, but also the fires in Australia, which is probably a good segue to climate change. I know you've said recently, and I should add the qualification that you give as well when you make this statement, that you believe the Republican Party is the most dangerous organization in human history. And you add that you know that's an outrageous statement. But could you elaborate on that? Why do you say that?
Well, let's go back to the first Paris negotiation. The goal of the Paris negotiations was to reach a treaty in which countries would commit themselves to specific reductions in emissions, and it would be verifiable since it's an international treaty. Now, that couldn't be done for one reason. The Republican Party would not agree to allow that to happen. So what happened instead was just a set of promises without any, not carrying any force, which is much less significant, of course. The subsequent international meetings tried to enforce these regulations. They were constantly blocked by the United States under the pressure of the Republican Party. The latest ones in Madrid, the US had a presence, but the sole role of the US presence was to try to prevent anything from happening, whether it's aid to other countries, fixed commitments to emissions, whatever it might be, disruptive. In addition to that, to being the only country, the only major country in the world that is refusing to take any steps to deal with this urgent crisis, The Republican Party is dedicated openly and publicly to trying to maximize the threat, to use the maximum, have the maximum possible use of fossil fuels, to cut back on even domestic regulations that would, just for the benefit of the population of the United States. So just a couple of days ago, President Donald Trump issued an executive order, probably illegal as the courts will determine, but he issued an executive order to essentially dismantle the major environmental protection legislation. It goes back 50 years to Richard Nixon to monitor and control the poisonous substances going into the water supply and many other such conditions. The idea is to maximize the coming destruction and to harm the population of the United States as much as possible. Sounds strong. Just take a look at this, at the legislation. And it's very interesting to see the thinking behind it. So the National Transportation Authority, about a year ago, published what in my mind is one of the most astonishing documents in human history, literally. It's an environmental assessment, careful, long environmental assessment, a couple hundred pages, concludes that by the end of the century, temperatures will have risen 4 degrees centigrade. Anyone who follows this knows that the scientific community, the World Bank, describes such a temperature rise over pre-industrial levels as cataclysmic, and basically the end, over twice as high as the maximum level they think is possible for organized human life. And after having drawn this conclusion, this made this assessment, they draw a conclusion. Conclusion is we should put no further restrictions on emissions, automotive emissions. They don't give the reasoning, but I guess you can imagine it. We're going off the cliff anyway, so why not have a good time while the fun lasts? I can't think of another interpretation, except maybe staying well somewhere here. If you can find a document like that in history, I'd be interested in seeing it. But I mean, what comes to mind maybe is the Wannsee, the declaration of Nazi Germany, 1942, deciding to murder all the Jews, kill 30 million Slavs. Pretty awful. But not saying, let's destroy all of organized human life on Earth, which is what they're saying. I mean, we have to remember that we're coming pretty close to a level of global warming of about 125,000 years ago, when sea levels were about 6 to 9 meters higher than they are today. Try to imagine a world in which that's the case, let alone acceleration of the vast acceleration of what's going on in Australia, in Brazil, the extraordinary with the droughts, huge droughts that are causing enormous problems all over the world. India with temperatures reaching 50 degrees centigrade last summer, and Rajasthan. Just I think what this means for much of the world. I mean, it's just no words to capture. So it is the most dangerous organization in human history. I think it's a pretty credible statement. And it's kind of interesting to see how this happened. We know a lot about it. You go back 10 years, 2008, the Republican Party was beginning to move towards steps to try to deal somehow with global warming. They were toying with the carbon tax, cap and trade, and so on. John McCain ran for the presidency on the Republican ticket in 2008 with a part of his platform was efforts to deal with the threat of global warming. What happened? The Koch brothers, huge energy corporation, who'd been working very hard to try to get the Republican Party to be denialist, to deny that global warming is happening, went into high gear. They launched a juggernaut under the leadership of David Koch, recently deceased, bribing senators, intimidating them, developing fake grassroots organizations which would knock on doors, a huge lobbying campaign. It turned the party around. That was enough to turn the entire party into basically denialist. It was interesting to look at the last 2016 primary campaign, the last presidential campaign. During the primary, which was the cream of the crop of the Republican Party, every single proposed candidate either denied that what is happening, or said it doesn't matter. The moderates, Jeb Bush, favored with the establishment, he said, well, maybe global warming's happening, but we don't think we have to do anything about it. The most remarkable was John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who was regarded as the adult in the room, the sensible person, too moderate to be possibly elected on the Republican ticket. He said, global warming is definitely happening, serious, but we in Ohio are going to keep producing coal and we're not going to apologize for it. That's the worst of all. It's like the labor minister in Australia, the opposition party, who's right in the middle of what's happening with the continent burning down, is visiting a coal mine to explain that we have to increase our production and export of coal. And that's quite consistent with our policies of preserving the environment. Hard to find words to describe behavior of this kind. Of course, Trump is off on, he's way out on the extremist end of all of this. But notice it's the whole party, the Republican Party, which he by now owned lock, stock, and barrel. No one is there daring to say a word in criticism of him because they don't want to enrage the adoring majority Republicans today regard Trump as the greatest president in American history, surpassing Lincoln, who was the favorite before. And it goes beyond this. And Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, alleged to be the serious person in the administration. He suggested that God sent Trump to the United States to protect Israel from Iran. We're living in a world of raving lunatics with enormous power to destroy it, which they're using.
What about the fact that you mentioned India, but countries that are developing and lifting themselves out of poverty, like India and China, as they go through the process of development, they tend to pollute more and contribute more to climate change. You've spoken of how the Republican Party has blocked action in the US, but do we in the West really have the authority, morally or politically, to tell developing countries not to use cheap fossil fuels to improve their standard of living?
We have the moral responsibility and the capacity to assist them in getting off fossil fuels. One of the elements of the COP negotiations since Paris is to fund developing countries to help them move towards renewable energy. That's what the US, meaning the Republican Party, systematically blocks. Once again, a couple of weeks ago in Madrid. So we have, and there, this can be done on large scale and small scale. But take India. India is becoming so hot over the summer that it's barely livable. And people, if they can afford it, are trying to get air conditioner. Well, it's a poor country. So they're getting cheap air conditioners, which are highly polluting. How much would it cost the West to provide India with up-to-date non-polluting air conditioner? I mean, it wouldn't even be statistical error in the budget, but we can't do it. Now, the fact of the matter is that these countries are taking steps. India is, in fact, taking some steps, significant steps, to move towards renewable energy. And China's doing more than anyone. They're still the largest polluter, but they're taking steps beyond any other country to try to overcome this. China's produces more electric cars than I think the rest of the world combined. It's way in the lead in developing sophisticated, mass-produced solar energy and wind turbines. And interestingly, the United States, which is the major danger to the world, is trying to impede Chinese development. One of the charges against China, a lot of charges against China, but one of them is that they have an industrial policy program, which among other things is moving very ambitiously to deal with the threat of climate change. We've got to intervene to stop that, because that allegedly violates our sacred the free trade principles, which of course we violate all the time. The reason you and I are able to do what we're doing now is because of US industrial policy in the 50s and since, which developed the technology for the high-tech economy through state and massive state intervention all the way through. And this story goes way back in history. But we have to impede Chinese industrial development. That's very important, including their leadership in renewable energy and their efforts to try to expand it. I mean, somebody looking at this from outer space would think that this species is just insane.
What do you think, on the issue of climate, I don't know if you've paid attention to the Democratic debates at all, but it's come up very few times. And I mean, some of the questions that do get asked are so trivial. I believe Greta Thunberg is now advocating for media outlets to refuse advertising dollars from fossil fuel companies. Do you think that would make much of a difference in terms of the coverage that climate change receives?
Probably not, unfortunately.
Yeah.
For one thing, the same. I mean, that could only happen, first of all, if there was a serious understanding of the urgency and scale of this threat. Without that, it wouldn't happen. And if you had that understanding, you wouldn't need it. I mean, the fact of the matter is there should be a screaming headline every day in the mainstream press about the fact that we're going off a cliff and we're not doing much about it. Greta Thunberg is trying to get them to say. I mean, you probably listened to her talk at the COP25, mm-hmm. 10-minute talk, very eloquent, very accurate, lots of details which were exactly accurate, very well said. But what can you say about a world in which a 16-year-old kid has to lecture the great figures of the world on their failure to address a threat that within not very long is going to undermine organized human life. We have to listen to a 16-year-old kid to tell us that.
Yeah, it's there has been in the past decade a global rise of the far right, and it comes at just about the worst possible time during this what's deemed a make or break decade for climate change. The El Paso killer, the white nationalist who wrote a manifesto before the shooting, mentioned environmental catastrophe, and this has come up among a lot of far-right figures now, and they're worried about mass migration. They have slogans like, you know, save bees, not refugees. Are you worried at all that if we don't do anything, there could be some kind of rise of what's sometimes called eco-fascism?
There's plenty to worry about the far right, but I don't think this is a major part of it.
Okay.
And there's much more to worry about the mainstream. What you said before about the democratic debates, which incidentally I'll admit I don't watch, but I read about them. What you said is quite accurate. I mean, they're focused on impeachment for the crime of having the president having tried to harm a leading figure in the Democratic Party. That's the focus of the impeachment, that Trump used his office to try to get another government, Ukraine, to find harmful material about Joe Biden, the leading candidate in the Democratic Party. That's the issue, the big issue in the world. Incidentally, does that remind you of something? You recall an event called Watergate?
Sure.
What was Richard Nixon charged with? Well, there were efforts by several congressmen, one of them Robert Drinan, a priest from Massachusetts, to include in the articles of impeachment some of Nixon's crime, like the bombing of Cambodia, for example, which was a horrifying crime, all knocked out. The only issue that was left was that Nixon sent some petty thugs to break into the Democratic Party headquarters. That's the big issue with Richard Nixon. Big issue with Donald Trump is going after Joe Biden, Democratic Party candidate. And that's the lead issue that the Democrats are focusing on,
right?
Which incidentally will almost certainly turn into a gift to Trump. You can predict it. Senate is obviously going to exonerate him. He'll parade as with a triumph. We, the people, finally managed to undermine the deep state, the raiders who were trying to destroy the presidency. I could make up the propaganda easily. So it's very much like the Mueller report, which predicted was going to be a gift to Trump. So is this. That's what we focus on, not his attitude, not his policies on global warming, which are going to destroy it. That we barely talk about, and the press as well. Occasionally, in fact, it's kind of interesting to watch, to read the coverage in the best newspapers in the world, New York Times, London Financial Times, really serious newspapers. Just take a look at their coverage of fossil fuel issues. Euphoric. United States just passed Saudi Arabia in producing fossil fuels. That's great. Now we have energy independence, but we don't have other countries impeding our policies. The fossil fuel industry is investing more in profitable fossil fuel extraction. Long, detailed article. Try to find the word global warming in those articles. I mean, sometimes you read about environmental problems. So, long article in the New York Times by one of their best correspondents, Clifford Krause, on Trump's expansion of fossil fuel exploration in the United States. And there is a mention of an environmental problem. At one point he says that more drilling in Wyoming for fossil fuels may harm the local ranchers whose water supply may be affected. But is that the big problem? I mean, they all know about it. It's not as if there's any lack of knowledge. Just as the CEOs of the big banks know as much as we do about the threat of global warming, while they pour funds into fossil fuel extraction, including the most dangerous of them, like Canadian tar sands. It's as if there's some kind of schizophrenia. I mean, on the one hand, we know that we're destroying the possibilities for human life, and the other half of our brain, we can make some more money tomorrow. Again, it's pretty hard to find words to describe this.
Yeah, it's almost like a drug addict knowing that what they're doing is killing their body, but they just can't stop. You've talked about the stakes of this election. Are you someone who's worried? I mean, I know I don't want to put you in the prediction business, but are you worried at all if we nominate a centrist like Biden or Buttigieg that just sort of could be a 2016 election do-over and re-elect Trump?
Well, I think it's imperative in this election that Trump not be elected, almost by anybody, first guy I meet on the street. If he's re-elected, we know what's going to happen. There'll be an acceleration of the kinds of destructive and threatening programs to which he is committed. Maybe worse, because the second term of a president usually gives an option to be more free in what they do. There's no indication that this is going to change. Incidentally, it's not only global warming. There's something else that nobody's talking about, almost. It's just a series. And that's the dismantling of the arms control regime. The threat of nuclear war is quite serious. And that's really essentially permanent. A country that carries out a first strike in a major nuclear war will itself be destroyed simply by the effects of nuclear winter. And that's coming closer. Now there was a series of treaties which somewhat reduced the threat of nuclear war, which has always been extremely high. You look at the record, it's kind of miraculous that we've escaped. But there were some treaties that reduced the threat. One was the ABM treaty, important. That was dismantled by George W. Bush. Second is the INF treaty, which banned short-range nuclear missiles in Europe. Very significant. That was signed by Reagan and Gorbachev in 1987. That's just been dismantled by the U.S. government, by Trump administration, just last August. Timed it very nicely, a day or two before Hiroshima Day. And plainly, they'd been planning this, and of course they'd been planning it, but very strikingly, right after dismantling the treaty, the Pentagon launched a missile which violated the treaty, virtually pleading with others, come along and find ways to destroy it. We've opened the door. The next one on the table is the Open Skies Treaty, initiated by that terrible left-wing radical Dwight Eisenhower. That's going to go. That's reduced the threat that one of the major powers, Russia, the United States, would misunderstand what's happening and launch missiles. That'll go. Now, the last one is the New START Treaty coming up in 2021. Trump administration's already indicated they're not going to sign that. In fact, the preparatory steps to do so haven't been taken. That ends the arms control regime, essentially. And it says, let's develop the most destructive weapons that we possibly can be happy about the fact that we want to destroy ourselves. Now, some people are happy about this. If you read the literature of the arms industry, the military industry, they're delighted, they're ecstatic, getting huge contracts to develop weapons that destroy everything, and also thinking that a little way down the road, they'll get even bigger contracts to try to figure out ways to defend against the monsters of weapons that they're developing now. So it's just a perfect world. That's just as serious as global warming. And there's virtually not a word about it. This is not just my opinion, incidentally. So if I take William Perry, former Secretary of Defense, the leading specialist on nuclear weapons, devoted his whole life to it, and a pretty conservative guy, not given to exaggerated rhetoric. He says he's not only terrified, but he's doubly terrified. One, by the growing threat. Two, by the failure to notice it. Amazing. It's hardly a word about it, except in arms control.
And why do you think that is?
Even my dog doesn't like it.
No problem. It's interesting you mentioned that, because I know during the later years of the Obama administration, they approved some nuclear modernization program that would have cost a few trillion dollars.
Under the pressure of the Republicans,
Was there, because sometimes when I've brought that up with people, they say, you know, oh, well, we also had really old computer systems on the nuclear weapons, and this actually made things more safe. Is that a legitimate argument?
You should take a look at the record. I mean, there have been case after case where failure of the automated systems virtually led to war. When it came within minutes of launching weapon, the terminal war, and when human intervention blocked it. So, for example, in 1979, National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski was just about picking up the phone to call President Carter to tell him that we're under a terrible missile attack, when information came in saying it was a technical error. Actually, this goes back to the first establishment of this system. I think it was back under Eisenhower. The first, as soon as it was used, immediately it warned of a 99% probability of a Russian missile attack. Turned out some radar had bounced off the moon in some way they didn't expect. And this goes all the way through. If we had time, I could go through details. But right. It is literally a miracle that we've escaped.
One of the things that I did want to make sure that I asked you about, a lot of these issues we've been talking about in many ways seem to fall back to a lack of accountability for especially people in power. And it really does seem like when you get to a certain level of wealth and power that you're really just not going to face the kind of consequences that ordinary people would face. And one of the cases recently that has really underscored that phenomenon in a dramatic way was the case of Jeffrey Epstein. And I only ask you because he was vaguely affiliated with MIT, where you had taught for many years, and he had donated to the Media Lab, interacted with top scientists and intellectuals. And this is after his first conviction, which the MIT Media Lab knew about.
After the conviction, but also after his serving his sentence, there's a principle of Western law that once a person has served a sentence, he's the same as everybody else. Seems to be forgotten. So there's some other interesting questions. Jeffrey Epstein gave, say, $1 million to MIT. He's the worst person who's contributed to MIT. What about in my office at MIT, when I was there, I'm not there anymore, I looked out the window of my office and I saw the David Koch Cancer Center. David Koch is surely a candidate for being one of the most extraordinary criminals in human history. I already described what he did. He was personally responsible for shifting the Republican Party from being moderately sane on, minimally sane on global warming, to being the most dangerous organization in human history, which may destroy us all. Is that serious? Seems to be pretty serious. Does anybody say anything about that? Well, take a look. When David Cook died a couple of months ago, the Institute president produced a laudatory encomium about how he's one of the model MIT graduates. He did such wonderful things for MIT. He even funded the basketball team. Just a perfect person. Something strike you as strange about all this?
Well, there's certainly hypocrisy there. Sorry, go ahead.
I don't know if hypocrisy is the right word. I mean, think about it. Why this obsession, but not much more significant one?
Well, the only reason why it was intriguing to me was the fact that Alexander Acosta, the labor secretary and the prosecutor who had given him what people regarded as a lenient sentence, said that he was told he belonged to intelligence.
That's fair enough. But then the criminal is Acosta.
Sure.
Okay. Not the person who was sentenced and released.
Is that something worth exploring? Or I know you have a deep well knowledge about the intelligence services. Is that the idea that they could be having some sort of sting operation with some guy involved? Is that just crazy talk, or is that something that could happen?
I mean, I haven't followed it in close detail, but sure. There's a lot of strange things about the alleged suicide. Just a couple of days ago, a report came out saying that the cameras were off and the backup cameras were off. Mm-hmm. Day after day, some very strange things come out. I don't know.
Right, and there's no real way of answering that question, or at least right now with the information we have. The last question I wanted to ask you, Bertrand Russell, who I understand is well-regarded in your eyes, was once asked, suppose this film was going to be looked at by our descendants in 1,000 years' time, what would you think it's worth it to tell that generation? I know you're not one for grand statements or anything like that, but do you want to take a stab at that question?
Well, sure. I would tell them, if you're alive and hearing this, it's a miracle, because your not so remote ancestors were acting in a way which was condemning you and everyone else to death.
Well, on that note, Noam, thank you very much for your time. It was a real pleasure.
Okay, good to talk to you.
All right, thank you to Noam Chomsky, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.